Perhaps I can move on to a third topic, which is just sort of the public debate about tax and perceptions. I mean, one of those of you that kindly attended the AGM and heard my brief remarks there would have heard me say that recently I was asked to speak at the conference of the Institute of Tax Professionals in Australia. Whilst I was there, I listened to a very interesting speech from a very senior Australian tax official from the Australian Tax Office, who actually made the point that although in Australia they've done a huge amount of work in sort of trying to address aggressive tax avoidance by the big corporates, and he was very supportive of that, he actually went on to say, I thought very bravely actually, that one of the bigger problems, and in fact a bigger problem than tax avoidance, was the acceptance by society of, you know, such things as, yeah, I'll take a discount for cash. I've made the point that I wonder whether in our society that's also something we ought to think about. I'm not suggesting that, you know, paying cash is illegal, immoral, or it's necessarily linked to tax evasion, but we all know that there are times when it is. And I wonder whether as a society we're too accepting of that. I suppose I'd just ask any of the panel, not necessarily on that particular point, but just whether you think we've now got the balance right, whether we need to address some of these really difficult issues of tax evasion if we're going to really try and deal with some of the issues of the tax gap. Professor Katz, I can start with you.
Well, I think it's a very interesting point, and it does come up every time the government does its tax gap figures. And the Institute, I think, in the last couple of years has been putting out a press release saying, yes, but evasion and other illegal activities are actually costing the Exchequer five times what avoidance costs. Now, those figures, I think people don't find very convincing because the avoidance number is very tiny. And when the public thinks of avoidance, they think of all the things that multinationals do, which are legal, but they would count them as base erosion and all the rest of it. But even so, clearly there's a big problem on evasion, and it is a difficult one to tackle. I remember the last election, Ed Balls got into trouble. He started talking about how bad it was that we didn't ask for receipts when people did things, cut the hedge or whatever. And so, of course, some journalist tracked down his window cleaner and found that Ed Balls didn't ask for receipts. And David Gawk got in a similar situation a little bit earlier, and a few years back he was sort of saying how it was morally unacceptable that, you know, kind of we do what John's just described. And personally, I think sort of this moral exaltation really isn't going to get anywhere. And, you know, if we need to crack down on evasion, you sort of need to think about other ways to do it, possibly incentives. And Portugal's huge success with its lottery VAT, lottery receipts. Sweden's got cash registers as a link through into the Swedish tax authority. I think Belgium does something with vouchers for service income. So there are practical things there. And the only other thing which strikes me as a problem in relation to this kind of slight this feeling that multinationals particularly avoiding loads of tax, and you know that's the central problem and everything else is a minor one. I think it does again get in the way of tax policy when it comes to thinking about the choices. What are the obstacles for the kind of broad debate that John was talking about? This feeling, well, there's 120 billion or whatever of multinational tax dodging, and if only we cracked down on that, we wouldn't need to do all these other things. So I think the distortion matters, but actually solving it's going to be very hard.
Paul, perhaps on a related topic, I mean, how significant do you think the public perception and the debate about the sort of regulation of tax professionals is and the behaviour of tax professionals? And obviously I'm thinking here about the recent changes that, you know, the ICAW and CIOT working closely together were drafted in relation to the professional conduct in relation to taxation and the impact of that. I mean, how significant do you think that is in relation to the behaviour of tax professionals?
And it, really, if I could answer that question by almost continuing the answer to the last, I think we can sit in this room and have a conversation about avoidance, evasion, what is legal and what is illegal, where the boundaries are, where the barriers are, where the difficulties are. We're all speaking the same language. We understand each other. Once we go outside this room, I think it's a far more difficult conversation to have, because part of it is heard through a different filter, and the filter is not what is legal, what is illegal. It's what is fair and what is unfair. And that's a very subjective filter, because what is fair to one person is desperately unfair to another. And when you then have that discussion reflected through politicians and, with respect, Vanessa, through some elements of the press, it's even harder to keep control of the explanations I think we desperately need to keep trying to make. I think it is incumbent on us to keep trying to explain. But I'm not pretending that it's an easy task. I think it's pushing a very large stone uphill, and I think we'll be doing it 5-10 years from now. But we've got to keep pushing it. We've got to keep trying to get a sensible explanation across of what these issues are.
I mean, Jill, better budgets sort of identified a sort of problem with the sort of quality of the public debate on tax. So who's responsible for that? Is it journalists' fault? Is it politicians' fault? Is it the public's fault? Is it our fault as tax professionals?
I think to quite a large extent, it's going to give a slightly controversial answer. I think it starts with the Treasury and the Chancellor. Remember, the Chancellor doesn't even have a sensible conversation about tax policy with any of his colleagues. Sometimes they let the Prime Minister in and have a bit of a debate there, but generally you don't even engage with most of your colleagues, certainly not about the sort of different range of judgments. I mean, Ian Duncan-Smith, I thought, actually made quite a valid point when he resigned in the wake of the March 2016 budget, that he was asked to sort of cough up this on personal independence payments, and the Treasury said, but you agreed to that, you agreed to that. He said, but I didn't know you were going to use it to pay for these other taxes. You know, it's when I saw it in the context of the budget that it starts to look, you know, Paul's word, very, very unfair. So I think the Treasury doesn't do very much at all to promote a good public debate or good public understanding, and I think it could do far more, and it could do far more by dispersing the sort of community of people talk about tax. I think one of the problems, I mean, the IFS is a fantastic institution and a national treasure that we definitely need, but one of the effects of the IFS is to almost crowd out anyone else from the debate about tax. I mean, if there is, you know, a tax thing to be discussed, the only person you ever see is Paul Johnson or one of Paul Johnson's people appearing to discuss that. And what is really interesting about the IFS is that it doesn't actually take on a sort of particularly great advocacy role. So what is really interesting is across a whole range of tax issues, there is no sort of non-self-interested advocacy organisation making a case for improving the tax system. In the Treasury, you are inundated with budget representations. Every budget, some of them arrive in a sensible time, many of them arrive far too late to affect things, even if they did make sense. But they're all from an incredibly self-interested viewpoint. So we don't actually have a good public debate about what a better tax system might look like, which means that, you know, we're starting off from a very low base. That is then refracted through the press. I mean, you know, the OTS sort of put their toe in the water with something on aligning, you know, income tax and NICs, and something that would cost people, what, the cost of a cappuccino a week or something, you know, and it's 9 million losers is the headline in the press. And, you know, of course the government doesn't go there, it retreats. We can't have a sensible discussion about VAT. I mean, there's a very good case for having a sensible discussion on some of the VAT zero rates. You know, I personally loathe the zero rate on children's clothes, because as an early Treasury official, I had to write all these letters to the parents of big children who didn't qualify. You know, you've got all these small women saying, oh yeah, I can get into that, or whatever. So there's, you know, there's a group of very dissatisfied mothers of oversized 12-year-olds or whatever who have to, whatever. And so, you know, it's a stupidly regressive thing to do. You know, if you gave the Department of Education £1.6 billion and they came to the Treasury and said, we're going to spend this all on subsidizing the clothes of people like David Beckham, Victoria Beckham, the Treasury would laugh them out of court. But we don't have any of that sort of debate. So I think we do need to actually have a real step change. And actually, I think the government needs to take the lead in saying, actually, tax tax is difficult, it's hard, but actually it's a serious thing, and we are all going to suffer if we can't talk about this properly and sensibly.
And so just fairly briefly, if I may, I mean, you know, so the attack's been on big corporates for a very long time. Do you think there's any evidence that that is going to let up, or do you think they recognise that that's just going to continue and they're going to have to live with it?
I think it's absolutely going to continue, but if I could shift the kind of my response to kind of take it a slightly different direction, maybe I've caught a dose of some of John's optimism, but if you look at Brexit and what Brexit might bring, it might trigger a bit more of a debate and a bit more interest in the kind of competition elements that Jill was touching upon earlier. You know, we might see the government start to use tax as a lever to attract and build the economy and to attract more investment. That might help people understand the role that business plays. It might enable them to engage a little bit more in the tax debate and where it goes. You know, we've already had some discussions, not just in the FT, about state aid and what that may mean. And again, if people start understanding the trade-offs that we have to make as part of negotiations for tax, it starts making it a bit more real, and there's a different angle to allow people to access the whole tax debate.
Thank you. Can I have some quick comments from the floor on that?
Gary Richards, I'd like to pick up something Stella said rather directly, which is, of course, should we be using the tax system as a lever for investment? Because actually it has we set up some rules, we then chuck in the anti-avoidance, we then probably react to some of the avoidance. Particularly if following Brexit, should we actually be looking at, and this will be pretty difficult for this government, picking winners, dreadful expression, but actually are we using the tax system, are we deliberately complicating the tax system to do incentives when actually, particularly when state aid might have disappeared largely by 2019, should we be more direct? I'm just saying that we talk about tax complexity, but then we're urging the Chancellor to do things that's probably going to make it more complex.
Thank you. Other comments? There's one over there.
Yes, at the risk of making anyone here from HM Treasury need some smelling salts in a second or two, I wonder about whether one way forward to address this, the issue about the amount of tax that's raised and what it's spent on, is to do away with, in selected areas, the Treasury's rule against hypothecation. The areas that I might would be interested in would be the NHS and the state pension, where maybe some more direct linkage between the amount of tax in the broadest sense that's raised and the benefits and the expenditure incurred would be useful in the tax system, so we can break out of this problem that any raise in tax is considered to be wasted on what every individual might see as the government's least favourite thing that they do.
One more over there. Is that Ian? I can't see.
Thank you, John. Just one comment, and it's, when did equity begin to creep into taxation? You know, it's a hostage to fortune if we actually start saying it's not fair, or we want to have taxes that are fair, because that opens up a debate that is never ending. I mean, we can all say we don't think a particular tax is fair or a particular tax is very good. There was a discussion going on around here earlier on about development land tax. There's no tax on development gains at the moment. Is that something that should be introduced because it would be fair? I think that we need to be very, very careful if we start going along a line of saying we want to have taxes that are equitable, because it means that we're going to have another slide rule introduced in looking at tax policy, which is never ending and which will never find any form of satisfaction.
Thank you. I suppose, Stella, the first comment was about something you said, so I have to give you a right to reply. Should we be using the tax system in this way?
I think whether we think we should or we shouldn't, we will. I know we start kind of aggressing onto other areas, but tax competition isn't going to, if we decide that we're not going to use it because we'd rather have a simple system, then we could stand around and watch other territories go past us, because they will be using it. We've seen that, and we'll continue to see it. Unfortunately, I completely agree. Unfortunately, we can't have tax competition and simplification. I'd like them both. I always like my cake, and I like to eat it. But I think we just got to get used to the fact that we will have tax competition, and there will be more complication. We just got to try and do it the best we possibly can.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to the next topic rather than take all of those questions through, because I think a number of those points were in themselves sort of observations rather than comments that needed responding. So if I may just move on briefly, there's just one further point I want to talk on, which is sort of just broader policy direction. And the sort of very neat segue into Stella's previous comment. We're going to have Brexit. Thinking about VAT and Brexit, it's fairly clear that on day one, we're going to sort of import everything, all the EU case law and so forth will apply. I suppose, John, the question is just how far do you think how long it's going to be before our VAT system and the EU tax system become somewhat divergent?
I suppose there is a parallel for what's happening with the so-called, Great Repeal Bill, which is kind of what happened when Ireland became independent and they enacted into the Irish constitution a sort of reenactment of all the British laws with the status of Irish laws going forward. And I think, in fact, that sort of, they were slightly more honest because they didn't actually call it a repeal section, they called it a transitional section. Although not totally honest because the transition section lasted longer than the constitution itself. The transition section had to be reinserted into the next bill. By and large, Irish judges had the good sense, I think, to follow, to regard continued British cases as persuasive. There was a sort of notorious example where they didn't do that, which was over Furness and Dawson, where they said that for the courts to impose a sort of anti-avoidance doctrine was a breach of the Irish constitution because, in the British context, it was fine because Britain had no proper constitution, was a bit of a mess, but the Irish constitution had sort of separation of powers, and for the judiciary to arrogate to themselves the job of the legislature was, not quite right. Now, but that was the exception. I mean, by and large, they have, enjoyed, continued certainty, but that, of course, is in the context of both being common law countries, so I would be rather fearful of a kind of fairly random divergence that just sort of adds to uncertainty for no particularly productive way. I mean, I would like to see us either do something really radical, like we were talking about before on food. Although I guess we could have had VAT on food while being in the EU, but VAT and food and financial services and goodness knows what. Or I would like to see voluntarily deciding to kind of accept the continued European case law with the European court, so at least small businesses would, who are trying to trade across Europe, would have some certainty that way. I mean, I would be fearful, we'll just make it about the same mess that we've made all our other taxes. And similarly, with no longer the constraint of state aid, we will waste money on random subsidies that involve us in pointless competition and are counterproductive. So I'm afraid I'm sort of filled with misgivings about our new tax freedoms post-Brexit.
So in the last few minutes, just a couple of additional points I'd like to pick up on. Paul, I mean, one of the things that was raised in the finance discussions before the election was the sort of potential dangers to the economy from sort of issues of self-employment versus employment and incorporation. How do you think that that sort of challenge might be dealt with going forward?
We've got another 2 hours, haven't we, John?
Yes, so you've got precisely 1.5 minutes to do that.
I mean, clearly this is something that's on the Chancellor's radar. We had the marker down in the autumn statement last year. It resurfaced in the budget. I'd like to be clearer on what exactly the concern is, other than, again, I think we come back to this fairness lens that people outside this room view tax through. I did a radio phone-in with Radio Devon the day after the budget. And most of the debate around tax, because the self-employed thing came up as a question, most of the debate around it was self-employed people phoning in and saying, you people with jobs, you don't know how good you've got it. and people who were employed saying, self-employed, you're all tax dodgers, you're just putting everything through. And again, I think that illustrates how hard a task it's going to be to come up with something that solves the technical problem that is actually understood by the people who are paying the tax. I don't envy Philip Hammond the task of actually trying to square that circle.
So, I mean, what's your take on this? I mean, is the big problem employers, NIC? I mean, what should we be doing about this?
I think here, again, there's more. We're talking about tax, and we're talking about tax in isolation, and I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. Again, with the Matthew Taylor report, and again, a little bit with our tax avoidance debate, it's not just about tax. There are other issues at play here, and the debate needs to encompass all of those issues and not just focus on tax. If we look at the tax issues in isolation, we're missing a huge chunk of both the motivations, but also the consequences. And my worry is that lots of the headlines end up around tax and don't look at the bigger issues. And I know that the OTS's report, and that's John, did look at some of those different things, the behavioural changes, and the reasons why people are doing the things that they're doing, the reasons why people are working the way they're working, and also the broader environment. And all of that needs to be looked at together. So I'm really looking forward to the Matthew Taylor report, because I know there'll be more of those things kind of highlighted. And I hope that, I think one of the things that we'll get out of that is that actually more research needs to be done into some of those areas. So rather than having a knee-jerk reaction to some of the recommendations in the report, that, as Jill said, given that tax isn't even featured, that then those issues and some of that research and broader issues are brought into looking at where tax can go and how tax can help solve and address some of those issues.
Thank you. I suppose my final question to both Jill and Vanessa is, you know, to think about from a broad policy perspective. You know, we've had a triple lock on tax for a while. You know, there are various things that are definitely not going to be increased. The parties have been somewhat more circumspect about exactly what they're locking at the moment. But how practical is it, do you think, that we continue with this sort of triple lock, that we're not going to raise some of these big taxes, which will make significant differences?
The so-called fiscal responsibility lock was a stupid idea when it was floated in the 2015 manifesto. I mean, Amit Gill, who was David Cameron's strategy advisor at the time, said it was the dumbest economic policy ever invented to fill a space in the grid. They needed an announcement that day, and that seemed easy. Putting it in legislation was a stupid thing to do. And basically, if you lock out all those big first, you know, big sensible places to go, I mean, you may say politically you can't change them, but if you lock those out for a parliament, you are forced to raise revenues through loads of sort of odd devices, second best things, and you just cramp your style, and it's a stupid thing. So I think our real hope is, and the Institute for Government's put out what it wants to see people do in their manifestos, and this is big things we don't want people to do, is to commit themselves to things that are unrealistically unaffordable and constrain their options in a necessary way. So hopefully we survive the next 5 weeks without Theresa May or Philip Hammond being forced to concede either the triple lock on pensions or the fiscal responsibility lock, and that will give them a degree of freedom of manoeuvre that they need for the next Parliament.
Well, that's the same question to you, but I was going to give you the final word.
Totally, yeah, agree with everything Jill said, and it's just going to be very interesting to see in the next few weeks. They will be pressed a lot, particularly on the national insurance issue, because they're now very sensitised to it, and so it will be quite impressive if they manage to hold the line on it. But it's a funny sort of election, so I think there's a strong possibility they might. I hope so anyway.
Can I thank on your, I'm going to have to bring this to an end. I'm sorry, we could love to carry on talking about this all day, but I'm conscious we're now standing between you and a glass of wine, so that's probably a dangerous place for me to be. So can I, on your behalf, thank all of our panellists for a really interesting and insightful discussion.